Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
What used to be a very colorful tundra landscape is now quite charred, and most of what we had there has burned up.
Fire burns the Pebble Mine Project's supply camp and in the interior prompts evacuations. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, July 7th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, what to know about ranked choice voting ahead of the special election.
We need to think really hard about who these candidates are. And even amongst the people we disagree with, who would at least be the best at answering my phone call?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
The Clear Fire in Interior Alaska made a run in the Kobe Road area yesterday. Clear Fire Management Team Operations Chief Dwayne Van Wert says wind drove a mile-wide swath of flames north along the fire's eastern side.
And eventually kind of overwhelmed the lines that we had into the edge of the Kobe Ag area and made about a three-mile run.
The Kobe area has been under a go evacuation notice, and an urgent update sent out late yesterday told those who had remained to, quote, leave now. Aircraft dropped water and retardant on the fast-moving section of fire, but Van Wert says firefighters had to pull back because of rapidly advancing flames.
There's a few structures in the area, and there's a few residents that we kind of pulled back from what was going, that the firefighters grabbed and took with them and got out of the area. I don't have any idea if there was any damage or anything, but it definitely ran through the edge of that subdivision area there.
Clear Fire managers confirmed this afternoon that fire had moved through areas where there are structures, but said the extent of fire reach and damage remain under investigation, adding that the Denali Borough is in charge of any notifications. Van Wert says firefighters went into a point protection mode last night to defend structures, most of which are located east of Wednesday's fire movement. He says the fire did not get any closer to the city of Anderson and Clear Space Force Station, which remain about 6 miles away. Team fire behavior analyst Forrest Ownby says the localized fire run was weather-driven.
The sky was very clear, and so we had a lot of sun on the vegetation and everything. The temperature actually rose to in the 80s, and then the relative humidity dropped, and it dropped into the 20 percentiles. And so on the east side of the fire, we saw a lot of activity and a lot of increased fire rates of spread and trees torching and movement of the fire.
Ownby says activity calmed overnight, but firefighters are prepared in case similar conditions repeat.
The forecast is warm and dry, so we have a high potential to continue to be in a fire season till we get several days of precipitation.
One of a dozen new wildfires over the past 24 hours is located northeast of Fairbanks. Fire Information Officer Jose Acosta says the Little Chena fire cropped up last night in a remote but full protection area, and firefighters responded.
Engines and a helitack, fire spotters and ATVs, and a couple of air tankers. Initially, it was about 10 to 15 acres.
Work continues on the Little Chena fire. Thousands more lightning strikes hit Alaska yesterday and this morning. There are 237 active fires in the state. Well, the Upper Tellaric fire in southwest Alaska has caused significant damage at the site of the controversial Pebble Mine project northwest of Iliamna. The fire is part of the Lime Complex and burned through Pebble's supply camp over the 4th of July holiday weekend. That's according to Mike Heatwohl, a spokesperson for the Pebble Partnership, who said the mine had stored equipment for exploration at the camp. Despite the material damage, Heatwohl says no one was injured. The Alaska Division of Forestry says as of Wednesday, the fire covered nearly 8,000 acres. Heatwell described the damage of supplies as a near total loss.
What used to be a very colorful tundra landscape is now quite charred, and most of what we had there has burned up. In some cases, tents, canvas tents, supported, you know, by metal and other things. The metal, you know, got quite hot and collapsed, so it's not really salvageable.
Heatwell says the fire also burned wooden pallets and railroad ties used to minimize the impact of drilling, along with tools to maintain the site's equipment. Heatwell says Pebble sent some workers to the site today, and the company is still working with fire managers to take stock of the fire's impact. They don't know yet how much this will affect Pebble's operations long term. Cale Casey, public information officer with the incident management team, says this year's fire season is unprecedented.
We reached 1 million acres of wildfire impacted landscape 10 days before we ever have in recorded history of Alaska.
Heatwell emphasizes how much the Pebble partnership appreciates the management team's response to the fires.
It's a fire, it's devastating, but it's just things, right? There was no one harmed, and that's a much better story.
Casey says more information will be made public once a thorough assessment has been done. Commercial salmon fishing has begun in southeast Alaska for seiners, trollers, and gillnetters. Most of the salmon runs in the region are forecast to be below average to average this year. Coast Alaska's Angela Denning reports.
Five different salmon species are making their way to spawn in rivers and streams throughout the region. Some are part of indigenous runs, and others are hatchery grown and released. Overall, the southeast runs aren't expected to be strong this year.
We weren't expecting too great a runs overall as far as salmon goes.
Troy Tines is the regional finfish coordinator for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
So all in all, going into the season, we were expecting a poorer season than what we experienced last season.
By volume, pink salmon make up the largest commercial harvest in the region by far. The preseason forecast is for 16 million fish, which is considered weak. Pinks are on a two-year cycle, with even years producing smaller returns. Most chum salmon in Southeast are hatchery produced. Tina says those operators are expecting low runs this year, with a total of around 8 million chum salmon. Southeast Chinook or king salmon has had poor returns region-wide for several years. And that's not changing, says Tines.
For the systems that we do forecast for the most part, we're projecting runs that would come in below the escapement goals.
Escapement goals are the number of salmon that managers want to see reach spawning grounds in order to sustain future runs. But like weather forecasts, salmon forecasts can change. Last year, for example, managers predicted an average pink salmon harvest of 28 million, but it ended up being over 48 million fish. This year, they forecasted poor sockeye salmon returns for the Stikine River near Wrangell and the Taku River near Juneau, but the runs are coming in stronger than that.
So far, indications are that the sockeye abundance appears to be better than what we were expecting. So that's a big plus.
Managers are expecting average sockeye runs for the Chilcat and Chilkoot rivers near Haines. Coho salmon are the hardest species to forecast, so managers don't do many estimations. Tina says the fish spend a varying amount of time in freshwater before heading into the ocean.
Coho are just generally harder to forecast because of their variance in their life history. They can spend a number of years in freshwater, but they only spend 1 year out in the ocean.
Pinks are the only other type of salmon that spend just 1 year in the ocean, so managers can get some indication of how the coho run might go by watching the pinks.
Oftentimes, for pink salmon and coho salmon, there can be a correlation in their abundances because they experience the same ocean conditions. So if the ocean is good for pink salmon, it could be good for coho salmon as well.
It's still early in the salmon season, and fisheries are just getting underway in Southeast. But the commercial salmon industry is always an important economic driver in the region. Last year, the commercial catch was valued at over $130 million at the docks. Reporting in Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, how a bird rehab center in Anchorage is dealing with bird flu.
It takes about 2 weeks for us to get test results, so you don't know that they're positive until they're all gone.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing cargo transportation to 9 Alaska communities. NAC offers options including cargo charters to get freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 45 years. More at alyeskapipeline.com.
2 years in, gun suppliers are still seeing high demand across the U.S. for both firearms and ammunition, driven in part by panic buying from gun owners. At one gun store in Soldotna, spikes in sales often line up with things that are happening thousands of miles away. KDLL's Sabine Pooks has more.
When there's a big national news cycle, Michael Madrell knows. Not just from the Google alerts he gets to his email or the news he sees on his phone, but also from the business in his store.
Anytime anything happens with Congress or Supreme Court or gun control is brought up, people always come in and talk about it.
Madrell manages Soldotna Ammunition on Kalifornsky Beach Road. He says whenever there's unrest or something big in the news in the lower 48, even if it has little or no direct connection to Alaska, people come in and start stockpiling. That's especially true when there's any news related to gun control. Last month, Congress passed a gun law that enhances background checks for young people and funds risk prevention programs, among other measures, and it won't take guns away from owners. Still,
the gun control one always makes people feel like now's the time to hurry up and buy these things that they worry they won't be able to get later in the year.
But he says spikes in business are not exclusive to conversations about gun control. When the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, customers from all sides of the political spectrum came in to buy supply and talk politics. That was also true in 2020 and 2021 during the election and the Black Lives Matter protests.
So it doesn't matter if it's even happening in our community, just people fear that it's happening at all in our nation. They feel this is the time to get stocked up on whatever.
Madrell says some customers are concerned about personal safety when riots are happening in the lower 48. But he says in large part, buyers stock up because they're worried about the ongoing ammunition shortage that has hit gun supply stores around the country. And they think that any sort of unrest or chaos in the lower 48 could make that shortage worse. The shortage started in 2020 and came from a combination of national turmoil and production setbacks. Madrell says that it's improved as vendors and buyers have caught up with pent-up demand, but it hasn't entirely resolved. At a store Wednesday, there are rows of empty shelves where there would normally be stacks and stacks of boxes. And not unlike the toilet paper crisis early in the pandemic, panic buying has just been making the problem worse.
It always causes that little bit of panic. And we financially benefit from it, but we try not to encourage it because panicked customer base doesn't really help anything.
Customer Steve Milliron comes into the store 2 or 3 times a week to check out new inventory. It's not far from his house, and he knows the guys who work there. He's noticed the ammunition shortage. He says he was shooting less to spare his ammo when it was at its peak. Ammo.
And so I think what it's caused me to do is try to probably keep a little bit more of a supply of ammo than I did before and always try to replace what I shoot.
So, when something does pop up, he says he might be more likely to come in since things aren't always available. And he thinks his friends are doing much of the same.
Not so much really hoarding, but just because you don't know when you can find it. And sometimes a couple boxes of things will show up just randomly and you go, I could use that. And you get it and you don't see it again for months. So it was a good thing that you did.
It's not just recreational gun owners like Milliron who are driving sales. Soldotna Ammo sells supply to subsistence hunters in rural Alaska too. And Madrell says those hunters are also stocking up, buying more supply at one time in case ammo hits another supply chain hitch.
Actually, I've been planning to try to go to Bethel and Mountain Village and a few of those ones around there to see what it's been like there. I know the prices they're charging for now are much higher because a lot of them, just like a lot of businesses, do a percentage over whatever they pay. And the cost for the ammo costs more now. The shipping it out there costs more. There's hazmat fees that we didn't used to have.
Not everyone's buying. Some people just want to see what other gun owners are thinking. Madrell points to one customer on the security camera who's browsing at a glass case. He says he comes in almost every day, though he rarely buys anything.
People spend more time in the shop, even if they're shopping less, because they want to talk about whatever big thing happened.
As long as people feel like there are big things happening nationally, he's not sure that traffic will let up anytime soon. In Soldotna, I'm Sabine Pooks.
Ranked choice voting is new and different, and Alaskans will have their first chance to do it next month when we choose who will represent us in the U.S. House for the rest of the year. We know many of you have questions. We had some. And here to provide some answers is Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin. Liz, I'm hearing some version of the same question over and over, and that is, what if I don't want to rank? I only like one candidate, I want them to be my first choice, and that's it.
Casey, your ballot will still count if you just choose one candidate. You don't have to rank, but you should.
Well, why is that?
Because otherwise you won't be fully exercising your power as a voter. It's very unlikely that any of the statewide races will be decided by just the first choice votes. We're going to essentially have an instant runoff. And as it turns out, we only have three candidates in Alaska's first ranked choice ballot, the one for the special election for U.S. House. So it's really easy to see how it works. So let's say you and your neighbor both like candidate C, and that candidate finishes last. If you do not rank any of the other candidates, you've had your say, and that's as far as your ballot goes. But what happens next is all the ballots that went to candidate C are re-examined to see if the voter indicated a second choice. So if your neighbor ranked a number two candidate, that ballot is added to the candidate's pile, and your ballot goes nowhere. So your neighbor has voted in the runoff election, and you sat that one out.
Okay, I get that that's how it's supposed to work, but emotions kind of play a role in this somewhat. And what I've heard is that there are voters who, after they make their first choice, they don't want to vote for either of the other two candidates in the special election. Like how some progressive voters are saying they'll vote for Mary Peltola, the only Democrat in the race, and they really just cannot bring themselves to fill in any oval for the Republicans, Nick Begich or Sarah Palin, even if it's for second or third place. I guess, you know, it might feel weird to someone to give a candidate they don't like any level of support.
Yeah. And by the way, that's true among Republican voters, too. Some of them, some Begich voters really have an aversion to Sarah Palin and vice versa, and they can't imagine voting for a Democrat. So they're in the same position. But a friend of mine who is a naturalized American citizen, and I think he really recognizes the awesomeness of being able to vote and really puts a lot of thought into it, he put it this way: why should I put my name to any of the candidates I can't stand? And what I'd say is that ranking your choices in no way diminishes your vote for your favorite. All it does is say, if your favorite is no longer in the running, who else do you want? Or who would be the least bad? If you really have no opinion on candidates beyond the first one, no opinion at all, if you absolutely have no preference, then fine, don't rank. But study their positions. Maybe there's a difference between them on an issue that you care about. Kevin Berry has an interesting take on this. He's an economist at the University of Alaska, and he applies game theory to this whole ranked choice voting thing. He says even when the remaining candidates are diametrically opposed to you on all policy issues, it doesn't cost you anything to fill in the rest of the ovals. You might still want to rank them based on other factors beyond policy, like who do you think would be better at representing Alaska at important national events, or who do you think would be better at constituent services? Berry says that the new system presents voters with more difficult questions, and here's how he put it.
In the past, we just kind of said, you know, who the candidates are is settled by a partisan primary, and then what team am I on, and I vote for that team. Now we need to think really hard about who these candidates are, and even amongst the people we disagree with, who would at least be the best at answering my phone call?
Okay, but what if someone is so passionate about their one candidate, they vote them as their number one, two, and three pick? Like maybe there's a Sarah Palin super voter out there who votes for her three times. What does that do?
That's essentially the same as just selecting a number one. If your favorite is eliminated, so is the rest of your ballot. There's no point in doing that. But yeah, your ballot would still be counted in the first round.
Okay, so it still counts just in the first round. I like this because I get to play the squirrely voter who comes up with weird things to do. Okay, what if I like two candidates equally and assign them the same ranking? Does that spoil my ballot?
The Division of Elections considers that an overvote and will toss your ballot at the point at which the overvote occurs. So if you correctly vote for one person as your first choice and then two candidates for your number two, only your number one will count. Once your favorite is eliminated, you have no other rankings that will count.
All right, Liz, last question. Now the most difficult voter. What if I don't like any of them? Does this ranked choice voting system still allow me to write in a candidate? And if so, does that write-in get ranked?
Yes, you can still write in a candidate and then rank your write-in. But the Division of Elections will only count write-ins if, in aggregate, they finish first or a close second in the initial results.
All right. Well, that was Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin. Liz, thanks for walking us through that.
Thank you, Casey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
Denali National Park and Preserve will require masks in buildings and on park buses starting tomorrow. The Department of the Interior requires masks at federal buildings when the COVID-19 level in the surrounding area is high. And that is the designation the CDC gave for the Denali Borough this week. According to the policy, people aged 2 and up must wear masks inside park buildings owned by the National Park Service, regardless of their vaccination status. Officials said in an announcement that masks will not be required in the Walter Harper Ranger Station in Talkeetna. The State Department of Health this week reported 193 new COVID cases in the Denali Borough. Almost all of them were tourists. It's been 6 months since the current strain of highly pathogenic avian influenza, or bird flu, was detected in North America. Past outbreaks have subsided in summer as warmer temperatures help stop the spread. But experts say Alaska's wild birds and colder weather could keep this bird flu spreading into the fall. Alaska Public Media's Katie Anastas visited a bird rehabilitation center in Anchorage and has this report.
So inside the garage door, we set up this quarantine tent. Birds are admitted here.
Dr. Karen Higgs is a veterinarian at Bird TLC, the Bird Treatment and Learning Center. She says they've made changes since the latest strain of bird flu was first detected in North America back in December 2021.
We have a foot bath and very limited people go in this space.
Bird TLC is one of a few bird rehabilitation centers in the state still accepting birds. Now, along with eagles with broken wings and orphaned baby ducks, they're also getting birds with bird flu. They've set up a tent in the garage where they take birds that arrive with symptoms. That's anything from respiratory problems to severe neurological symptoms, like seizures. Some eagles have arrived with such bad tremors, they're unable to stand.
And when they are that far along in the disease, there's no treatment. So we provide humane euthanasia for them.
This strain of bird flu is extremely contagious and can spread from bird to bird through saliva or feces. Staff and volunteers at Bird TLC change their shoes and clothes constantly and wash them with bleach. They've placed tarps over the tops of cages to protect their birds from wild birds flying overhead. Higgs met with volunteers on Zoom to explain the new protocol.
It has taken what we thought would be fun summer and turned it into quite a challenge.
Bird TLC has had a group of ducklings, an adult Canada goose, and a bald eagle test positive for bird flu. All of those birds were from Anchorage. They've also been sent eagles from Dutch Harbor and Valdez.
But it takes about 2 weeks for us to get test results, so you don't know that they're positive until they're all gone.
With the last major bird flu outbreak in 2014 and 2015, chickens and turkeys were hit the hardest. But this year, the new strain is also affecting eagles, geese, ducks, and other wild birds.
This strain of this virus is very different in the fact that it's having very significant mortality in wild birds where we have not seen that in the past.
That's state veterinarian Dr. Robert Gerlach. He says out of more than 210 dead birds the state has tested for bird flu, a quarter of them have tested positive. It could also last longer than the 2014-2015 outbreak did. Gerlach says that time, officials had stopped detecting cases by early July. Hot weather likely helped. But the fact that Alaska has wild birds testing positive could keep the flu spreading longer. Gerlach explains.
This state is colder and wetter than states in the lower 48. And so will we see the virus leave, or will we see it continue to circulate in the bird populations here through the summer? Because the big concern then is when in the fall, when those birds fly back down south, will they be reintroducing this virus back into resident bird populations?
Gerlach says information from the public will be key to understanding bird flu as it continues to spread.
I talked with the folks at U.S. Fish and Wildlife yesterday, and they said their hotline is just ringing off the hook. And so they have several people answering. Normally, there'd just be one person there. Now they have several people responding to calls on there.
Higgs at Bird TLC says the widespread use of the hotline may have some unexpected benefits. She says they've had around 40 fewer birds brought in this spring than last spring. She hopes maybe people are seeking more advice before trying to help a bird that might not need it.
I think everybody hopefully gains an appreciation for, seeing the wild birds out there, and people are watching them more closely. I think we try and glimmer a little bit of positive out of this, but it's been really hard. It's hard on our volunteers. It's hard on us to see these birds so sick.
She says as long as it's safe for the other birds in their care, Bird TLC will keep taking in sick birds and providing more data to the state. In Anchorage, I'm Katie Anastas.
If you see a sick or injured bird, you can call U.S. Fish and Wildlife's hotline at 866-527-3358. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Catherine Moncure in Dillingham, Angela Denning in Petersburg, Sabine Pooks in Soldotna, and Liz Ruskin in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby. Katie Anastas is our producer. And I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.